Welcome to Now. I'm David Berg.
And I'm Manny Eck.
Today, we'll hear how just a little exercise can have long-term benefits as we age.
Physical activity as a structured program can avert or delay major mobility disability in more efficiently than a health education program.
What is it like to suffer and recover from a traumatic brain injury?
Michelle Wee captures her first major golf title, but is she part of a trend in the sport?
Some artists are finding new ways to use old trash.
People always think of it as one thing when they're far away, and then when they get up close, they see that it's a plastic bag.
And we'll hear about a new telescope that allows scientists to stare deep into space.
That's all coming up on this Wednesday edition of Now.
Manny, do you work out?
Yes, I do, David. I actually have a personal trainer.
You do?
I do. He's expensive, but he's worth it.
Now, do you love him or you hate him?
It's love and hate.
When I'm tired,
I'm very feisty with him.
Really?
But I need somebody to push me.
Yeah, well, I have to work out to keep my weight under control. But I found out there's also a benefit as I get older because it keeps my bones from getting weak.
Do you exercise often?
Well, about 3 times a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you run?
I walk fast.
Okay.
I have bad knees, so I can't run or my knees will swell up.
Yeah. I think people tell me that if you want to work on your bones or you want your bones to be stronger, you have to lift weights. Is that it?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That's what I've heard.
And some people, because of a sedentary lifestyle, some older adults eventually find themselves unable to walk.
But exercise can help prevent that problem. As VOA's Carol Pearson found out, a new study looks at how lifelong exercise can help people stay mobile even as they age.
As we age, many of us become sedentary. That's what happened to Brian Ainsworth.
You get to the point to where you're comfortable with doing nothing.
Ainsworth joined 1,600 volunteers in a study about older adults and exercise. All had a high risk of losing their ability to walk. None were regular exercisers. About half attended health workshops and did upper body stretching.
Guys are looking great.
Ainsworth was in the other group that participated in a structured physical activity program. It included walking, strength training, flexibility, and stretching exercises. The study was led by Dr. Marco Pajor at the University of Florida.
We didn't require any special equipment to perform this program so that it could be applied anywhere in any environment.
In the 2.5 years that the study lasted, Ainsworth noticed a huge improvement in his mobility.
When I started walking here, it was like a 30-minute walk, and within a few months, I was up to an hour.
Mildred Johnston was also in Ainsworth's group.
Most of my friends and relatives are in their 80s. I am the only one in the group who is not using a cane right now.
Dr. Pajor says participants in the structured activity program were nearly 20% less likely to have problems walking a distance of 400 meters than those who went to health workshops and did stretching exercises.
Physical activity as a structured program can avert or delay major mobility disability in more efficiently than a health education program.
Participants in the physical activity group also noted psychological benefits.
It's given me more purpose. I'm doing a lot of things that I didn't do 4 years ago.
It not only helps your body, it helps your frame of mind, too.
The program didn't keep people out of the hospital or prevent deaths, but it's the first study that shows that moderate exercise can keep older adults on their feet. The study appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
So what about you? Do you find a way to get some exercise every day?
Do your parents have difficulty with movement or are they active?
Let us know your story by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And follow us on Twitter, at Now VOA Show.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that more than 1.5 million Americans suffer a traumatic brain injury every year.
Of those injuries, more than 50,000 people die.
But what about those who survive the injury? How do their lives change?
To find out, we talked with Dr. Diane Stoller, a neuropsychologist and sports psychologist and the author of Coping with Concussion and Mild Traumatic Brain Injury.
Dr. Stoller has personal experience with a TBI. She suffered a stroke while driving and then was involved in a high-speed crash. She also later underwent brain surgery. First of all, how do you define what is a brain injury, whether it's traumatic or a concussion or otherwise? What constitutes the medical definition of a brain injury?
Brain injury has two subdivisions. One is acquired and one is traumatic. Acquired would be something like a stroke. A traumatic brain injury is anything that is from an outside force.
And what are some of the symptoms that people with a brain injury will manifest typically?
Typically, they will have a sensitivity to lights. The most common is the headaches, fatigue. They have like a brain fog. Their mood can change. They can become very edgy. Most of them, it's the sleep disturbances, the headaches, are the ones that most people complain about.
And what are some of the steps that are the road to recovery?
There's three categories if we want to talk about traumatic brain injury. And they're based on the duration of time someone has been unconscious and having some form of amnesia or memory loss, either antegrade or retrograde. And so the first is barely dazed to 1 hour. That is called a concussion. If it's from an hour to 24 hours, it's a moderate. If it's between from after 24 hours, you're called in a coma. So when you were saying he was he's 6 months in a coma, is that's considered a severe traumatic brain injury? All three are traumatic brain injuries. All form dysregulation of the neural circuitry in the brain. But it's how long someone has been unconscious.
Now, you've had some personal experience with this as well. You suffered both a stroke and that led to a head-on automobile accident. What was your recovery process like?
Well, one of the things, when there is a concussion or brain injury that has been followed within a relatively short period of time with another injury, that's called second impact syndrome. So is that I had the stroke, passed out while driving, had a 60-mile-an-hour head-on, and then 5 months later, I had brain surgery, and I had a portion of my brain removed. So those three subsequent injuries, brain injury, because brain surgery is considered a brain injury, is that second impact syndrome. And then the symptoms, once you have this dysregulation, and if you have repeated hits, and it's not treated, and the brain doesn't, then you're starting to see what you see in CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, where now the actual protein that comes out, which is called tau, and actually eats the brain away. So that's the extreme. In my situation, it took me 7 years to learn to walk, talk, and recover.
How do you counsel people to handle the emotional changes that go on with a brain injury?
I have a whole chapter on this, and also go around giving presentations on that. It's grieving the loss itself. You go from being, you know, active 20-year-old, 30-year-old, whatever your age is, and all of a sudden now you've been catapulted to this 90-year-old who cannot remember what their name is. It's grieving the loss itself, that person who you were may or may not ever come back. You may regain many skills, but you still may never regain, depending on the severity and the damage that is done in going back to that dysregulation.
That is Dr. Diane Stoller. She is a neuropsychologist and sports psychologist, and she's also the author of Coping with Concussion and Mild Traumatic Brain Injury.
For more information, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts on this subject by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Tomorrow, way too far away. And we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now. We got right now. So get up right now. 'Cause all we got is right now.
This past week, Michelle Wee, a Korean-American golfer from Hawaii, won her first major tournament title at the U.S. Open.
Michelle has been a professional for 9 years and started her career by playing in men's tournaments.
But this was her first big win on the women's circuit, and it puts her in the company of players such as Annika Sorenstam, Paula Creamer, and NB Park.
Of the top 50 golfers on the LPGA rankings, 28 are from Asia, with the majority from South Korea. To find out more about the rise of Asian women golfers, Frances Alonso spoke with Susan Hess, the owner and designer of Golftini, a women's brand of exclusive high-end golfwear.
So many kids in Asia, these women, like, they're being introduced to golf at such a young age. That's why I think that they're succeeding, and they're playing golf. They're playing golf every day.
From your perspective, where do you see the future of women's golf? I mean, you as a businesswoman, and you're seeing the top-ranked players are now young women in the 17 age range now.
When I turned on women's golf on Sunday afternoon, and I turn it on, and the first thing I look at is the fashion, because I'm designing clothes, and I'm running a business, and looking for trends and looking for, that's the first thing I see. And then I look at their beautiful golf swings and I'm jealous and like, and all that. But I just see that golf is just, for women, is becoming just a huge sport. I do think that, and I've had some girls play on tour that wore my clothing line. And so I got to know them better. And I've met a number of the players. But I feel like it's still the men's tour and then the ladies' tour. I mean, they get more hype and more money and more exposure, where I think that the women will be creeping up and getting more exposure. But it's hard. It's hard to make money and to break into it. And, you know, the girls that I know that were on the tour and fought to be, like, on the LPGA tour and then back down to the Symetra tour, like, to pay their caddy is sometimes just their winnings. So it's a hard sport to commit and make any money unless you're top.
With this rise of more Asian women players, What are your business plans to expand into Asia?
That's an interesting question, and I'm opening my online business into Asia and have had some successes there.
Is it difficult as a woman entrepreneur to go from the U.S., from a company in the U.S. Mm-hmm. into Asia, in your experience?
I've gone into Malaysia and Germany and Australia and Canada. So it's really just finding the right people to help you break into it. It's really finding the right type of distributor to make sure that your product gets to the right place.
Is the Asian woman consumer different than an American consumer?
No. I think it's just a woman that has certain tastes and wants, they play a lot of golf. They want everything the American woman wants. They want the same thing.
So what about you? Do you have a favorite golfer, male or female?
Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can send us an email by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @NowVOAShow. Environmental Protection Agency says 32 million tons of plastic waste was generated in the United States in 2012.
The EPA says that only 9% of the total plastic waste generated in 2012 was recovered for recycling.
And the government says the category of plastics, which include bags, sacks, and wraps, was recycled at about 12%.
But as Faiza El Masri and Faith Lapidus tell us, some designers here have found another way to reuse that material.
Alida Irby enjoys starting her day with a newspaper. She'll read it later on in the day. What's more important each morning is getting the plastic bag the paper comes in. The mixed media artist recognized its potential about 3 years ago.
And as I was taking the paper out, I felt the texture of these bags, and they were soft. I just looked down and realized that it takes three to make a braid. And I'll put a few staples in here just to keep it from unraveling.
Since then, Irby has been using plastic bags to create abstract lines in her pieces. Before incorporating plastic bags in her work, Irby used natural materials like feathers, leather, and dried plants. All those elements highlight her Native American heritage and identity. Navajo bundles is an example.
I was replicating a hairstyle, a Navajo hairstyle, when the hair is heavy and it's looped back on itself. I took the piece of plastic bag and looped it back onto itself and secured it with a tie.
At the African American Museum and Cultural Center, Plaits and Ponytails, a collection of Irby's works, is now on display.
People always think of it as one thing when they're far away, and then when they get up close, they see that it's a plastic bag.
What we're going to do is we're going to lie them flat like this with the print up.
Amazed at how she turns trash into treasure, some neighbors asked her to teach them how to create art from used plastic bags.
I think it's fascinating. It's wonderful. And I do plan on sharing this with my seniors at my church.
I never gave any more thought to what to do with a plastic bag. This is definitely different.
I want to make a masterpiece that I can put in a frame and put it up on my wall, and then I know that I did it.
I think that we are all artists, really, and there's beauty all around us.
Irby says all you have to do is open your eyes and bring the outside in. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
To see some of these art pieces made from plastic trash, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter, at Now VOA Show.
Manny, do you like to stargaze? Do you ever go out at night and look up at the stars?
I do. I actually live in a house that has a beautiful garden, so at nighttime I do stargaze quite a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You have a favorite constellation?
I don't know if they are or not. I don't know what they look like.
Oh, really?
But I just stare into space quite a bit. That's just what I do.
Yeah, I tried to see that meteor shower. You know, there was a meteor shower last month. They were promoting it. Ooh, biggest thing. Whole lot of nothing. Of course, now I was trying to look with my naked eye. I didn't have a telescope or binoculars. Or
you
anything.
Weren't prepared?
Well, it's not that I wasn't prepared. I don't use that kind of stuff.
Yeah. My friend was supposed to wake me up at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
To look at it.
Yeah.
She woke up and there was nothing.
There was nothing.
Yeah. There was nothing. It was all a hype.
Plus, there was a lot of light pollution in my area. They've just built a new, like, apartment complex and stuff just down the street from me.
Yeah.
And so all the lights from the parking lot kind of make it hard to see. You know, I did actually crack open my wife's binoculars and look beyond what I could see with my naked eye. And when you look with some help, it's amazing how many stars there are out there, you know.
Well, while you're using your binoculars, David, astronomers have a new powerful tool for looking deep into space while trying to better understand the origins of the universe.
It is a new telescope that will look for signals coming from the coldest objects in deep space.
As VOA's George Putich tells us now, the last of its 66 dish antennas has been moved to its site in Chile's high desert.
Under an almost always cloudless sky in Chile's cold and barren Atacama Desert, 5,000 meters above sea level and away from any electromagnetic interference, ALMA's dish antennas listen to signals coming from distant cold objects. Even the coldest matter in space, such as dust and gas, emit signals between infrared light and radio waves, with wavelengths smaller than a millimeter. Catching them requires either a dish antenna of enormous proportions or an array of smaller ones with a supercomputer to consolidate the data. The equipment that receives those signals must be kept at even colder temperatures, says astronomer Gianni Marconi.
you have to amplify the signal that is really, really low in a condition that are really, really extreme. So this is the reason, because also our detectors are kept to the minimum temperature possible. We are a few degrees above the zero absolute.
Signals from ALMA's 66 antennas are processed in a supercomputer called Correlator. Electronic engineer Lorenzo Martinez says each of its four parts can process a lot of data.
We have 120 gigabytes per second that is produced in each antenna. Well, if you do the math, these are astronomical numbers.
It is tricky to combine the signals from several dish antennas. Scientists have to periodically rearrange them in order to find the best configuration with the least amount of radio interference. Juan Carlos Salamanca operates a special multi-wheeled transporter called LOR to move the antennas across the flat desert floor.
One antenna weighs almost 100 tons, and you need to transport it to 5,000 meters, and the truck needs to have the capability to work without a problem at 5,000 meters.
Marconi says the ALMA telescope will open a new window on the most distant early formed galaxies.
This is what is doing ALMA, an horizon looking at the beginning of the universe, at the beginning of the star formation, at the beginning of the formation of a cosmic structure.
ALMA is a joint project funded by Europe, United States, Canada, East Asia, and Chile. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
To see video of George's story and the ALMA Super Telescope, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. A museum in Tokyo has unveiled two new employees that it will never have to worry about feeding or paying. They're androids.
One of the lifelike androids, Kodomoroid, is a childlike female figure, while the other, called Antonoroid, is an adult woman.
The two were created and developed by Dr. Hiroshi Ishiguro of Osaka University. He told a news conference Tuesday that the two androids were the natural result of advanced technology merged with human form.
Smartphones or mobile phones are not the best media form for humans. Human is the most ideal medium or form that humans can easily relate to, as there are so many functions in the human brain. As technology develops, the form of many devices will be closer to that of human form.
The Kodomoroi will work as a newsreader for museum visitors, while the Otonoroi will work as a museum communicator.
I don't know if I like that, a robot newsreader. It could put me out of a job someday. You know, it's like, you know, okay, we get rid of him. We don't have to feed it. We don't have to pay it. All we have to do is turn it on.
But that's so weird. I mean, isn't it all about personality as a news anchor or as a reader?
Well, apparently these things have a little bit of a sense of humor or something, but they're still kind of, you know, like Walt Disney World-ish. You know.
I don't know. It sounds so inhumane.
It ain't C-3PO, you know. It's not carrying on a conversation. Although, the guy that invented it did kind of like, you know, say, you know, it asked him a question. Because one of these things kind of malfunctioned. He talked to it and it didn't talk back.
Now let's talk about fashion. Do they have fashion or are they just naked robots?
No. They're actually wearing clothes.
Oh.
The one that's supposed to be like a communicator, curator type thing was dressed very formally, you know, like a woman, like a businesswoman. And the newsreader was dressed more like, you know, like a kind of a teeny bopper anchor type thing.
Oh my God, this sounds like a bad sci-fi movie.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly Isaac Asimov, but it was close. It was close. So we'll have to wait and see what they develop next.
Okay, well, to comment on this story, log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow. Thanks for joining us for this Wednesday edition of Now.
If you want to hear the stories on today's show again, log on to our website, www.voanews.com/now.
And we're also on iTunes.
And if you want to comment on anything you heard, log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at NowVOAShow.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until Monday, I'm Manny Eck.
And I'm David Byrd. Join us again for another edition of Now.